To start out with this disclaimer, my personal stake in this business is very minor. I would say what I've meant for this whole business is basically nothing else than antisocial. Right? As a cosmetic guy, clinical pathologist, ADS, CFT, developed by Michael, very excited about it. Perhaps because I did learn string theory on a consumer level. I don't claim that I can do any professional calculation, but I do understand, you know, what is in the heads of the string theorists. And then I saw it becoming, you know, active in condensed matter physics, basically by Subhash Sachdev and Chong, etc. And I got just very excited about it, and I didn't hesitate to just advertise. I think it's good that string theory is advertised by people who have no historic stake in it, like me. This enthusiasm has only increased. And the program of this afternoon is basically the main dish by my string theoretical friend in Leiden, Konrad Schollen. I think his talk will be about the core businesses of this program. And I won't like to give it away right now. And I'm just, you know, volunteering to serve you an appetizer for the good mood. What is my good mood? I was really kind of flabbergasted when I saw, you know, the results coming out of the ADS-CFT as related to fermions, because I've been wondering for a long, long, long time about how to deal with fermions in a general way. That's of course the core business of hard condensed matter physics. You're dealing with electrons that are strongly interacting. And ADS-CFT tells to me wonderful stories, and I would like to highlight that in a short introduction, just giving the positive feelings. Then, to further amplify that, I would like to tell you a short technical story, which is about a particular way of dealing with fermion problems in yet another dual representation that you very likely don't know, that I feel is sort of talking with this ADS-CFT. So I can see things happening in ADS-CFT with fermions in this different language, and it's very limited. And the truth of the matter is that it's not a very convenient representation to work with. And I'm actually hoping that somehow some of you that are mathematically more capable than I am will pick it up. This is barely explored, this particular representation. And we feel very strongly that there's a lot of work to be done, meaningful work. And I would like to be done at least within 45 minutes in order to give Konrad all the space he needs, and also to save you energy. You need your energy for Konrad. Okay, it's about fermions. So, dealing with fermionic systems, what do we really know to do? Deep inside, it's this thing we learned as undergraduates. Fermions are doing Fermi-Dirac statistics. You go to a free problem, a Fermi gas, and they have the Pauli principle, you just fill up the levels and you get a Fermi energy and a Fermi surface. It's kind of a tragic fact that this is really the only thing we know to do all the time. And we can, of course, do perturbation theory around it, but it's like this lamppost, this is the single point of light we have dealing with fermion systems, and the question arises, is it general? Now, what you also know is that this Fermi liquid is perturbatively stable, and that's good procedure, and that's called, in condensed matter, Shankar functional renormalization group, I think, among string theorists, known as Polsinski functional renormalization group. And the bottom line is that you start out with a system of fermions that has a large Fermi energy, and you feed it with small interactions. And then you can formulate a neat functional renormalization group. It has to be functional because you have these infinite points on the Fermi surface, and you have to track your coupling constants at all these infinite points. So this can be formulated. You just integrate momentum shells, you get a renormalization flow, and very often, not always, but very often, you find out that all interactions are irrelevant, and in the scaling limit, you find an impeccable Fermi gas of Gaspar. Other things can happen, and you have gauge fields, etc., and I will come back to that. Now, the problem which is generic to modern condensed matter physics, and even old condensed matter physics, is that in reality, you're often dealing with a situation that the interaction scale exceeds by far the Fermi energy. But by much emphasized by Phil Anderson, I think he gets completely right. So when you live in the UV, there's no such thing as a Fermi gas, a Fermi energy, whatever. There is some mysterious scaling flow such that when you integrate to longer distances and shorter longer times, you might find an emergent Fermi liquid. A Fermi liquid that builds up in the scaling flow as kind of a relevant operator. Now this happens all the time. I guess the classic example is helium-3, where you start out at short distances with basically a von der Waals liquid, which is an extremely strongly correlated liquid. And that exists, say, at 3 kelvins or something. And then you go to 10 millikelvins. And somehow that system of very strongly interacting helium balls renormalizes in a Fermi gas of helium-3 quasar particles that are very, very weakly interacting. And just know about the Fermi principle and residual interactions render it to be a non-conventional superfluid. Now the issue arises, can other things happen? Things that are radically different from anything like the Fermi gas, not even closely related. My outlook on the central pursuit of condensed matter physics is exactly this question. The bottom line is, we have no mathematics on our side to answer this question. Different from bosonic systems with fermions, we have the so-called sign problem. I guess the most elementary way to see it is go back to the days of Feynman. He constructed the Bass-McGill for fermions to find out that Fermi-Dirac statistics gets encoded in the requirement that you have to sum over all permutations. And when you have an uneven number of permutations, it means that your probability in this partition sum is actually negative. So you have a negative probability. This non-probabilistic sum is a nightmare. So some people think that fermion signs are some kind of technical problem of people who try to do numerical quantum Monte Carlo calculations. Complete misunderstanding. When computers can calculate, mathematicians cannot enumerate, and physicists can think, generally. I guess perhaps the best way to say it is that Matthias Troyer, I saw Matthias, is he here, figured out not long ago together with Uwe Wiese. That his fermion problem is actually in the category empty heart. So when you claim that you can solve it, you can go to the Clay Institute of Mathematicians and cash in a $1 million prize. So this is the problem we're facing. We have no general mathematical framework that is on our side. Now why should we worry about it? This kind of Fermi gas, Fermi liquid paradigm has been extremely successful in the past. But to my view, the history of the last 30 years in condensed matter physics is that we learned about states of fermionic matter that are not controlled by the good old Fermi gas fixed point. You heard this morning about the high GC superconductors by Subir. The belief is, I share it with Subir and quite a number of other people, that this normal state is quantum critical, which is just another word for conformally invariant. So conformal invariance associated with a quantum phase transition at optimal doping is controlling the nature of that state. There are lots of empirical arguments that support that point of view, although it's controversial. A case that is entirely non-controversial are the happy fermions. And I guess in the first week there was attention paid to it. But let me just remind you. How does it work? You take some complicated intermetallic compound containing typically cerium or uranium, whatever. And these are characterized by a transition to an ordered state, most of the time antiferromagnets, magnets, at a low temperature. Then you apply a zero temperature influence like pressure or a magnetic field, and you drive the transition to zero temperature, you have here the solid phase transition. When this would be about just an antiferromagnet, then it would be about bosonic quantum criticality, and we know how to deal with it. But this stuff lives together with these fermions. So you find actually on both sides of the phase transition a Fermi liquid. But the problem is that this phase transition is clearly a second order quantum phase transition. This stuff up here has all the traits of a conformal state, like the linear resistivity, surface coupled plate. And on both sides of the phase transition, it can happen, not always, but there are a couple of cases that are very well documented, where you find out that the Fermi surfaces are entirely different on both sides. So there's a discontinuous jump, say, in the Fermi surface volume, which is well documented in experiment, when you go through the second order phase transition. Now this means that we are facing a problem of deep principle. Somehow this fermionic stuff is part of the criticality. And these two Fermi surfaces are sort of, you know, the two competing states. They live on the critical surface somehow. And now I ask you how to imagine, you know, an operator that can describe this. For bosons, we know how to do it. But for fermions, I don't think anybody has a clue. As said, when you go straight up here, you find a strange metal state, which is supposedly the real critical state. And it's now crucial to realize that actually these Fermi liquids are born at this point. So the UV is not like a Fermi gas or something. No, it's a strange critical matter that cannot really know about a real Fermi surface. And then there's a scaling flow such that you have this relevant operator making this Fermi surface that can either be small or large, that takes over at this point, and only here you have a Fermi liquid. So the Fermi liquid gets born from an ultraviolet quote-unquote state that itself is this fermionic quantum critical state. Perhaps the neatest way to see that this state is really critical, real conformal, is look at what happens with the quasi particle effect of mass in the Fermi liquid when you approach the transition. As it turns out, you find in experiments that this quasi particle mass tends to diverge when you approach the critical point, so the fermions get heavier and heavier and heavier. Now there's a deep justice here, because the Fermi liquid is not a conformal state, it has a scale Fermi energy. The quasi particle mass is usually just inversely proportional to the Fermi energy. So when you re-enter this critical state, you wish to have a scale invariant state, therefore the Fermi energy has to go to zero and the mass has to go to infinity. So the deep issue is, dealing with fermions, you have a scale in the problem, the Fermi energy, and that scale is rooted in quantum statistics, in Fermi Dirac. And now we're facing the difficulty that you have to find out the fermionic state of matter that can forget the scale Fermi energy. So it's really about the works of quantum statistics. And I don't think anybody really knows how to do this, at least to the point that I saw the things coming out of ADS-CFT, and it really excited me big time. Yeah, so I'm going to come back to that in one more slide. I'm critical about sort of the standard lore in condensed matter physics. We heard Hertz-Subir, and they are part of the mainstream. That's probably best called Hertz-Millis. And it takes this perspective that you start out with this very strongly interacting stuff at high energies. Then there's a transient flow so that you closely approach a Fermi gas plus bosons that can be interesting gauge bosons. And then the last part of the flow is these gauge bosons at the last moment destroy your Fermi liquid. Now, the whole point is, you go to high-frequency superconductivity, you believe that the linear resistivity is a signature of conformal invariance. And you find out that the resistivity stays linear up to the melting point of the crystal at 2000 Kelvin. When there would be this transient flow approaching closely a Fermi gas, you would see something else than just a linear resistivity. There's no sign of this EF of this Fermi gas, of this effective field theory, should be wrote down. It's given in just by the fact that nobody knows how to think in general about a fermionic state that is in no way derivable from a Fermi gas. So, you know, in a way, this school of thought, which is the mainstream internalist metaphysics, has its own control. You can say it's like a Jankopolsinski flow, and you just have this mean gauge boson that can blow up in its decoupling sense the Fermi serves at the last moment. But all this Fermi information is coded in, you know, at the starting point of the model. And you're dealing with a real sort of interesting fermion problem. The starting point of the model is like a helium 3. And there's no such thing as a Fermi gas anywhere in the open fire line. Now, what is the big message I get out of both the story that Conrad will tell to you and the story of Hong? They are somewhat different, but this is a much more fanciful affair about, you know, the things that have interpretation. I don't want to get into it. Both of them reproduce this fact that you start out with a UV that's governed by conformal invariance. There's no Fermi surface, no Fermi energy. You study the fermions in ADS CFT, and you find out that there's a truly emergent heavy Fermi liquid, at least in the case of Conrad, in the infrared. Truly emergent in a sense that at no point you have to assume that there's some kind of UV Fermi gas or something. No, it really is created out of that microscopic quantum critical state, as if there's an operator that can make Fermi surfaces out of critical view. So this is really my reason to be very excited about it. It's a problem of principle that's not, you know, very evident when you go to IGC or radical net matter meetings, for the simple reason that we didn't have any mathematics that could do this. Now there's a second aspect, and it's basically about whole new story. I don't want to take your time to review all of that. So Hong Yu is telling us that the infrared of this fermion problem is controlled by this two-dimensional CFT lifted horizon of the black hole. He insists that this is a truly critical state. It has no knowledge of Fermi energy, but somehow it remembers the Fermi surface. So there's this, basically this line of singularities out there in momentum space that looks like a Fermi surface. It looks like a Fermi surface. These are non-Fermi liquids he's talking about. Now, KF is an inverse length scale. And the question arises, how can it be that when you have a conformal fermion state that obviously forgets about the Fermi energy, how can the state still remember this length scale KF? Another way of, can I just finish the sentence and then I'm happy to take the question. Another way of addressing this question is like, we listen to, for instance, Fentel. We haven't tried to do that this meeting. You might also listen to Sunsik and Subir. When you take this more recoupling point of view, somehow this Fermi surface seems to take a different role. There also you think that you get a real conformal state that's still remembering the Fermi surface. Can we understand this in a more general way? Why is it so that the Fermi momentum has such a different status, perhaps, we are not sure, than the Fermi energy? I saw a question. So you start out doing your canonical interacting fermion calculation. You say, I have a kinetic term there, epsilon k, c take a k, c k, then I know how many fermions I have. And from that I calculate a Fermi energy. That I call a bare Fermi energy. then you switch on your interactions, and this bare Fermi energy is not given. It is something that is actually changing in an interacting system. Once you go to that fermion, and you find out that given that the mass of the heavy fermions can exceed 1,000 times the bare fermion mass, you find an enormous Fermi energy that is smaller by a factor 1,000 than the bare Fermi energy. You go to your Fermi liquid regime, there you can talk about Fermi energies, otherwise they don't exist. Only when you can do your filling up of a Fermi gas, you can talk about Fermi energies, right? Then you figure out what the mass is of your quasar particles, and then you can estimate what the real Fermi energy is associated, you know, with Fermi Dirac statistics for non-interacting particles. That is the bare Fermi energy. I'm talking about the normalized Fermi energy. If they can have the Fermi set precisely clear what they need. You have no longer a Sommerfeld specific heat acceptor. I mean, it has a problem if you don't have Fermi energy there. The gamma of the specific heat. Not original. Yeah, the Fermi energy runs like hell. Yeah. It's even a bit tricky because a Fermi energy can only really be defined when you have a Fermi liquid, right? I define it as that energy scale caused by using Fermi Dirac to fill up non-interacting fermion states. That is also like a chemical Fermi energy. It's like when you're dealing with a real solid, say with copper oxide or something, then still these core states of copper atoms are of course filled up. So the use of the word normalized Fermi energy is really associated with first establishing that you have a Fermi liquid, then you know that you have to scale renormalized Fermi energy. And you just have, you know, a bare Fermi energy that this book needs to show up as a scale in it. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. And the chemical potential also set by, you know, the increased energy of copper atoms binding to oxygen, right? So that's another. But it implies each other, right? I'm talking about gamma in CV is gamma T, and that gamma I write as 1 over F, the potential state. Yeah, bare mu. Yeah, so I asked Hong the following question. What is the relaxation time in his fluid? When you are conformal, the relaxation time is h pi divided by k v t. In a Fermi liquid, it is EF renormalized divided by t times h bar divided by t. Right, so this is t squared resistivity. Right, so the resistivity knows about the fact that you have a scale diluting degrees of freedom. So this might help to confuse it. It's the best way I know to say it. Yeah, so there's the attachment between KF and the energy. That's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, probably you should ask Hong to exactly see how this can happen in the ADS CFT. I don't quite understand it, but we believe that condensed matter, that these things happen. Okay, I'm already half an hour in my slot, and it'll give the introduction. Because now I would like to further illustrate this. It's a very spherical computation. I don't claim that it gets anywhere close to any physical reality, but I think it's kind of useful to have it in your head because it illustrates how differently you can think about fermion problems. For that, I need to take you quickly through an alternative representation of the fermion passing model. It was figured out by David Sepulveda, a person that's mostly active in Fontes Mortales some, you know, 50 years ago or so. And it was very well known. Probably there are four papers about it. However, in this particular presentation, you in essence geometrize the workings of Fermi Dirac statistics. You can think about it in terms of geometrical structure, which I find very fascinating. However, to illustrate how it works, I will quickly take you through the Fermi liquid, how it looks like in this representation. And then I would like to tell you a quick story about the fact that in this representation, you can construct, or we discovered a way to construct a truly typical fermionic state, where I believe that you can see how in this representation you can decouple KF from things that happen along the time direction. And you can read it in these two papers. Now, to get at the point of how can geometry be important when you're dealing with fermions, I have to take you back to basically high school, where you learned that the simplest way to understand fermions is by the requirement that the wave function is n-symmetric in exchange of coordinates. Now, this you can visualize in pictures. Take the example of a gas of three fermions in two dimensions. And now imagine the following. This wave function lives in configuration space where you have n number of particles times d space dimensions. It's a very big space. But you can make a cut through this space by just putting coordinates of all particles except one at random positions. They make a two-dimensional cut through configuration space, and now you can ask the question, where are the zeros of the wave function implied by the fact that you have this asymmetry? Surely, the wave function vanishes when particles get coincident in space, simple particle principle. So let's read the picture. Here's our test particle, the green dots are other particles. The wave function has to change when the test particle gets on top of the other particle. And this defines the Pauli hypersurface that has dimensionality nd minus d, because you have d constraints. But this is not enumerating all the zeros, because this implies one constraint. So there's a surface where the wave function goes to zero with a dimensionality nd minus 1. Linus cut, count quickly the dimensions. These have to appear as lines, and that are exactly these lines where the color is changing from blue positive wave function to red negative wave function. Now, of course, the Pauli hypersurface is a submanifold of this nodal hypersurface. Now, in one dimension, they are coincident, and this is a secret to bosonization. So you can encode the nodes of the wave function just in hardcore conditions of effective bosonic particles in higher dimensions. You have this nodal hypersurface that's sort of hanging free from the position of particles. It can play games. And this is sort of an important thing. So what's the constraint particle? It's an exact rewrite of the Feynmanian fermion particle. It's all written in terms of your space, but you don't have to, it's very general. So let's stick to this world line representation. And then the bottom line is that you can get away with a particle where you just sum over even permutations, meaning that this becomes a probabilistic sum. There are no negative probabilities. At the expense of a constraint, and the precise formulation of the constraint is that you have to look at a full fermion density matrix where R is all positions of all particles, and you have to calculate it from R to all the configuration at the time tau, imagine time tau, where tau ranges between 0 and h bar beta. And you have to insist that only configurations are counted such that they don't cause a sign change of the density matrix. Now, when you can solve this problem, it's precisely equivalent to the full fermionic particle. And it's proven by separately. Now, the way to picture this is like, it's not precise, it gives you have some feeling of how these things work. Imagine these wave function pictures of the last field graph, stack them along the time direction, connect all these other particles by real lines, and then ask what your test particle can do if many enters around. But when it sees its nodal surface, it feels it like reflective bounding condition bounces back. And now repeat this exercise for all particles. You have the two version of articles. Thank you. Now, to give you a quick impression how you can now think about thermal policy in the stent, let's go to the Fermi gas. And there, life gets very simple when you can solve it in one way, you can solve it in another way, because the single particle momentum is conserved in the Fermi gas, so you know to write down the single particle propagator. You can construct that from that, the full density matrix just by taking the product and taking some of the permutations. Now you just do it and you find out that the sum of these permutations just turns into what I like to call a model constraint. How does it work? Go to a finite system, you get a grid of momentum points, and then the prescription is that you can stick in one world line on every momentum space point, but not a second. This is just like a model installation. Now living in momentum space. And then because of momentum conservation, the world lines go straight up. So what is this actually? It's nothing else than a system of cold atoms in the classical limit that they don't tunnel around, forming a model insulator of the lattice in harmonic trap, because you still have to worry about the kinetic term here. And it's like a parabolic potential. So the Fermi gas is in this representation just this mod state of cold atoms in a trapped living momentum space. Now when you think about it, this is actually the way we explain deep inside the Fermi gas to undergraduate students. But now it gets this literal interpretation in terms of a bosonic type system, which we find funny. This we always figured out 2 years ago. Let's now go back to real space, because there I have to be when I continue the story in part two. So when you go back to real space, you have to Fourier transform that mod constrained surface, and that just turns into an exercise of determinants, your usual Fermi determinants. So you have to ask the question of what are the zeros of that determinant when you want to know where the nodal surface is. So let's try to read it. We live in real space, there's this picture of these meandering world lines, forming these confining areas for each other. When you assume that a nodal surface is a smooth manifold, a non-singular manifold, given that the Pauli hypersurface is a sub-manifold of the nodal surface, it immediately follows that this nodal structure has a characteristic dimension, which is basically free volume where every world line can fluctuate around. And that volume is set, the linear dimension of it is set by the particle distance. So just trust me, you can directly figure this out when you sit down for 3 minutes. Now what happens when you plug quantum particles in little prisms, when you confine them, you get zero point energy. You can quickly calculate what it is. This is, in this representation, the Fermi energy. How is the Fermi surface encoded? This turns out to be way more tricky. It's basically like we have this determinant, and you shift a coordinate of one particle somewhere, all the zeros will shift. So, in fact, this nodal surface is a highly non-local object. But only so when you have a sharp Fermi surface. And that you can easily see. When you go to finite temperature, you can write down the thermal density matrix, and you sit down, and you find out that there's a non-locality length, which is Vf times this Fermi liquid coherence length, which is Ef h by 5 by k with t squared. Such that at distances shorter than this, you have this non-locality shift from particle all node shift. And at distances larger than this, it forgot. So when you smooth out the n of k, you lose this global property. And this will be important in all terms. Now we would like to think about a state of fermions. Yes, John, sure. Yes, I'm getting that quickly. You want to think about a state of fermions that has no knowledge about EF. That's an energy scale you cannot afford. I just argued that when the nodal surface is smooth, it necessarily has a scale. I mean, when you let meandering world lines loose in that system, it will always remember the scale. There's no way it can forget about it. So the only way that you can get rid of the Fermi energy is when you turn that nodal surface into a fractal manifold. It just looks like this. This is a joke. I apologize for this. But I cannot resist it. So this is scale transformation of the thing. What is it? Cauliflower? Mark, before I do the joke. I can encode the side problem in the geometry of the nodal surface. And for this very general geometrical reason, right? So scale invariance in the geometric sense very simple, it's fractality. The claim is that this nodal surface has to turn into a fractal. Otherwise, I will always remember the Fermi energy, regardless of what I do to my world lines, as long as they form a liquid. It's conjecture, right? I don't claim to prove this, but I challenge anybody to prove the opposite. I think it's very hard to get it out of. I don't see how this can happen. Okay, let me do the joke. So this thing, what the heck is it? Cauliflower. So we take a little piece of it, amplify it. Still looks like cauliflower. Take again a piece of it, amplify it, looks like this. Do it again, looks like this. This is not a joke. This is the way these cauliflowers work. Now the issue for this is, you talk to a layman and you want to explain what scale invariance is. And then this cauliflower is great and even made it up to the level of science. And they had a special issue about quantum matter. Anyhow, the very last part, I can do it very quickly because I really should get off this stage. So I would like to now figure out a way to construct a state of fermionic matter having this fractal nodal surface. And that's not easy because, yeah, you have to start somewhere, and this Sepley pattern rule is not solving the minus sign problem at all. Now, the good news is that when you go to the long time limit, the density matrix just turns into the product of wave functions, transient wave functions. So, in principle, this fermionic information in the IR is encoded already in the transient wave function. Not saying the transient wave function solves all your problems, but this is a true statement. So I need a wave function offset, and here we were just lucky. There turns out to be a wave function, notably in a dating back to Feynman himself, that is accomplishing this fate. What is it? It's a so-called Feynman-Cohen backflow wave function. This really arose when Feynman was wondering about excitation of helium-4. Well, basically think like helium-4 is like a classical liquid, it's quite incompressible. We know what happens in classical hydrodynamics when you move an object at a velocity that's small compared to the velocity of sound for that liquid. It behaves like an incompressible medium, and the water molecules in front of the stone has to get out of the way in order to let the stone move, and you get this dipolar hydrodynamical backflow pattern in your flow. Now, Feynman figured out that he could wire in this physics in a very simple way in terms of a wave function ansatz, which is like just a plain wave, where the novelty is that you have here not the coordinate of the particle, but the collective coordinate, which is like the coordinate of the stone plus the sum over all water molecules, and the difference between the coordinate of water molecule and the stone divided by some envelope function that better be algebraic. Now, these things you can now plug into a slightly determinant, and these Feynmanian backflow wave functions have a history in helium-3 in quantum Monte Carlo, used for practical purposes. That's the reason we knew about it. So, a couple of years ago, I called this great postdoc, von Kühling, did all the hard work, asked him, have a look at the nodal structure of this backflow wave function. And von produced this neat picture. And this neat picture is part of a bigger picture. Coding is the same. When you go from red to blue, you have the zero of the wave function. The black is just optical makeup to let the picture look more beautiful. Now, your eyes say that this is a beautiful picture because it is scale invariant. Now, turns out to be a bit massaged. You probably already noticed that you find all these notes, the sign changes at very short distances. That can be suppressed, it's unphysical. But Funk demonstrated that this fractality is actually true in infrared. When you go to large distances, then you have a true fractal. There's a Hausdorff dimension which is hanging in between ND minus 1, the smooth nodal surface, and ND, dimensionality of the configuration space. Question arises, great to find this interesting wave function. What does it mean to this physics I addressed some time ago? These wave functions are flexible. So we have this envelope function here, and it's encoding two length scales, an ultraviolet cutoff you better take of order of interparticle distance, otherwise you get very unphysical short distance nodes. But there's this so-called backflow range parameter sitting here, and it's controlling the infrared. And when you and you find out that when this parameter exceeds the interparticle distance, you get these interesting fractal sinks. So let's illustrate that. You start out with zero backflow range. You just have plane wave shape for this smooth total surface. You make it finite, and you find out that at short distances, you get these erratic node changes. Make it larger, and you find out that these pops start to overlap. And when you look closely, you can find out that this is actually like you have a geometrical correlation length. So at large distances, you still have this smooth total surface. You zoom in and you get the distances shorter than this correlation length, and you find out that you have a fractal nodal surface. You approach that quantum phase transition, and that is where this geometrical correlation length diverges, and you enter this difficult space. So it's geometrically mimicking a Wilsonian renormalization group flow. You have only a wave function. All we can do is calculate a momentum distribution. But from that you learn something interesting. You learn about the mass of the quasar particles. So start out at A0, you have the full set of Fermi gas. You have this finite range fractality. And you find out that you have this Fermi liquid gas, you already discontinuity gets reduced. You tune it towards this quantum phase transition, this discontinuity gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And the point completely disappears. You have a smooth kind of thing. So the bottom line is, this is an example where you start out from local from the criticality, and at large distances, it finds out that it's supposed to be a Fermi liquid. And it's the only example I know of, you know, explicit mathematical constructions other than ADS-CFT that are completionist feet. That means I wanted to tell you. This I skip because of time. Just to address the very last issue about the difference between EF and KF, there is at least in this particular language a way of understanding that, which I find interesting. So the fractality originates in the zeros of this determinant, and it's obvious that this is again non-local when you shift any of these coordinates. Things will change everywhere, and the fractality really builds up because you have many, many, many coordinates there. It's like this overlapping thing I already referred to. So when you get this fractal nodal surface, you have nodal pockets of all possible sizes, and therefore you cannot have a unique pocket size that gives you a unique EF, so this gives room to have a conformal dynamics. But now you can wonder, how is the Fermi surface encoded? Eventually, this is coming from this gas of backflow particles. It's only the bare particle coordinates seeing all this fractality, and there we encoded a KF. Now the KF is still in here in this global way because we only take K less than KF. And in the Fermi gas we saw that this means that KF is actually encoded completely globally in the real space nodal surface. So, we haven't proven this, it's very hard actually to get a handle on this, but I conjecture that there has to be still a surface of singularities at where the Fermi surface used to be in the Fermi liquid, reflecting this fact that it encoded in this non-locality of the nodal structure. And the bottom line is, dynamics is encoded locally, it's about these nodal pockets of varying sizes. KF is encoded globally. I think at least a proof of principle that you can have this detachment between scale KF and anything else. This brings me to the end. So fermions at finite density. The fermion signs are wrecking established mathematical machinery, so there's room for big surprises, I'm optimistic, that's stuff to discover. I find that ADS-CFT has started to show its presence. The emergent thermal liquid you'll hear about by Kunrad, and what we already heard by Hong. Then I find it's a fun question, and you might come with a much better answer than I have. Does a critical thermal liquid need a thermosurface? Or are there critical thermal liquids that even forget about a thermosurface? And I have the story about the Scandinavian backflow, suggesting that there are at least critical thermal liquids that still have a thermosurface. Let me stop here. Thank you for your attention. We know it looks like very interesting. You start out with this backflow gas, right? So you write things later, you determine in terms of these backflow coordinates. So you can write it as there is a beautifully thermal system made out of backflow particles. Now, the transformation from backflow coordinates to bare coordinates is extremely singular. Right, so these annotated pictures took like a month of supercomputer time to calculate it. They're bad. You can think about what it is. I think you kind of understand it. It's all about its non-locality. But now you can work your way back and ask the question, this free backflow particle Hamiltonian does mean what in terms of bare particles? And you find out that the structure of that bare particle Hamiltonian is like is a sum over n, where this is the coupling constant backflow range divided by interparticle distance, and that becomes of order 1 at the critical point. And then this n is about c dagger c to the power n. So what you get is a divergence in n, where n refers to n-body interaction. That's as if the first correction, when you do a perturbation theory, the infinite order first corrections get important. That it's an extremely singular thing you're doing here, and in a way, now these thermal liquids are extremely stable. I interpret this as a fixed point Hamiltonian, and to destroy a thermal liquid, you somehow have to destroy this hierarchy in endpoint interactions. Right? In a Lennard thermal liquid, you say all interactions are irrelevant, but a two-point interaction is the least irrelevant, and it's less irrelevant than a three-point interaction, because if you have to destroy that hierarchy at a fixed point to get this critical thermal state, right? It's not like a transition, it's really like a line of critical state. This thing changes when you exceed critical backflow. Thank you. Okay. That's right, I got this before. You are really... Pretty nice, right?